Hey folks, Jordan here. Welcome back to the BME podcast. I know we took a bit of a longer break than I was hoping for, but these things happen, I guess. We ran into some scheduling conflicts, and I am just not reliable. But I think we've got that all sorted out now. We've got some pretty interesting, entertaining guests and features lined up. And start today with Elaine Angel, who many of you probably know. She's been around the piercing industry for over 20 years now. She has seen it all, and she has just written a brand new book called The Piercing Bible, fittingly enough. So stick around, and right after the break, we're going to talk to Elaine Angel. I see problems down the line. So we're here with Elaine Angel, author of The Piercing Bible and doer of many other things. So welcome, Elaine.
Hi, thank you. Nice to talk with you.
Absolutely. So let's just start off with the book, The Piercing Bible. How did this come about? When did you decide to write this?
Well, ever since I started writing articles for The Point and for Pain Magazine, I realized that there wasn't a whole lot of printed information circulating about body piercing, and I had been thinking about it for years, but what finally happened to get it going was I was at the APP conference about 5 years ago, or maybe that was going on six, and a woman came up to me and she said, "Hi, my name is Lee, and I'm really interested in piercing, and I'm thinking about writing a book on the subject, but I'm not a piercer." And I said, "Well, funny you should mention it. I've been thinking about writing a book, but I haven't gotten started on it." So she and I collaborated, and she actually came up with the basic outline and the foundation of the book, and we worked on it together for a while, and at some point she kind of backed out of it and handed it over to me, but it was about 5 years in the making, and so finally it got published and is just being released right now.
Right, and the review is up on BME now, or it will be as the podcast goes up at least. And I was really surprised because I was expecting it to be more of a procedural, whereas it's not. It's very holistic almost. I thought it was going to be more...
I think it's as broad as it could possibly be in hopes of containing information for anybody and everybody who has some interest in piercing or a need for information about the subject. So my primary market when I was writing it and who I was thinking of were piercees and potential piercees, people who are interested and people who have them. And so there is a lot of basic information in there because I can't think of any place where any of that information is really all set out in one easy spot. And of course, the internet has so much information, but not all of it is accurate, and it's pretty scattered. So there is a lot of basic stuff there. And then I did go into detail on each of the piercings. I discuss anatomy pretty thoroughly. And I think most piercers, even if they have a lot of experience, are apt to find some hints and tips and goodies in there that will help them and inform them. And also, one of my main target markets was medical professionals and other people who deal with piercings, like parents, educators, sports coaches, you know, anybody who comes into contact with people who have piercings. And there's information and answers in there for them as well. So part of the reason the book has a conservative tone is because I wanted it to be accessible and acceptable to these other types of people as well. So I guess maybe having read it, you might be able to give me your perspective on whether that was successful.
No, I think it was. And as the book goes on and you move away from just going like piercing by piercing, basically, I know that you move into, well, how do you adjust to like living your life every day as a person with piercing? So how do you look for jobs? Do you want to be a piercer? Like those sorts of things that have more to do with the culture surrounding piercing than actual piercings themselves.
Yeah, it's, well, let's see, what is it, 23 chapters, and, you know, they cover the whole gamut from thinking about it to having them, stretching them, other, you know, types of body modification are touched on. But yeah, there's talk practical aspects of living with piercings and dealing with them throughout life. I've had some of mine for decades now. It was kind of shocking when I do the math.
Yeah. Now I know historically in piercing, it's been a funny community and industry because it obviously wants to gain legitimacy, and you know, people want to be able to get pierced and still be able to live normal lives, get jobs and whatnot. And people who do piercings still want to be able to participate, so they want to have that integration with everyone else, and they surely do in a lot of ways. But there's also it's a guild, it's a trade, it's something that people want to keep a little bit secret, so not that everybody can just come in and do it. So was there any pushback from anyone that you were writing what may be perceived as a guide to piercing that everybody can just pick up and learn from?
Well, obviously, anybody who knows anything about piercing knows that no matter what anybody wrote, it wouldn't be good enough as a method of training to teach somebody to pierce, and certainly that wasn't my intent, and I don't think of it as a how-to book, even though it does go into a lot of detail. I think that tattooing comes from that tradition you're talking about, where the techniques were very jealously guarded for each artist, and people were very much on their own for learning. But if you look at the tradition I come from at Gauntlet, Jim has been forthcoming with his information from the start and even made a magazine, PFIQ, to help share his information. So I come from a tradition, while it's obviously another form of body art, much like tattooing, I don't think it suffered from that same type of secrecy that tattooing has, at least that wasn't brought to me in my tradition. Right. So I don't feel like I'm giving away any secrets, and certainly the information has always been available to anyone who asked me. I've done a lot of that, what's in that book, one email at a time.
Right.
So.
Would it concern you at all, though? Not to say this is necessarily the case, and not that it was your intent at all, but would it concern you if young people or anyone treated it as a how-to and they thought, well, now I don't need to go to a professional, or I don't need to get an apprenticeship, I can just start piercing people out of my house and that's fine because I read a book?
Well, I hope the book was clear enough in explaining all of the reasons why that's inappropriate and unacceptable and a really bad idea. And
which you do, of course. But
okay, so there's that. And then there's the other aspect, certainly knowing how many people are piercing themselves at home and how many piercers are out there with a minimum of training, that if this helps people get better piercings than they would have without it, however that comes about, whether a professional learns something new from it that helps, or whether somebody who's hell-bent on, you know, doing it for their girlfriend at home, however it helps better piercing come about, I guess that's good work.
Yeah.
Even though it's my intention to train home piercers or half piercers, anything that cuts down on botched jobs is a good thing, I figure.
Right. Is there anything in the book that you wish that you got into a bit more? I mean, I know there's just a very small section on microdermals, say, which are getting much more popular now, but I don't know if you have just not personally done as many as a lot of the younger or newer people have, or if it's just something that you didn't think was experimented or worked with enough to discuss yet?
Well, there's two different questions in there, and I have two separate answers for them.
Sure.
One is that everything in the book has less information than I originally put in that I would have liked to put in. When I had my manuscript over to the publisher that became interested, it was almost 160,000 words. And they said, well, we're interested in your book, but can you do it in 100,000 words? And so we talked about it at length, and I said, you know, I really want to get my book published, but I don't think that would be the book that I'm trying to write here. So no, but maybe 135. So we compromised, and ultimately I had to chop out a lot of what could have gone in there, and I regret that, but it wasn't in my power to get it published and have it all in there at the same time. So that's one answer. And then as far as the microdermals or single point piercings or dermal anchors or whatever you want to call them, I have not done them. I have had one done for me. It's something that I think is viable, and at the time of the writing of the book, there really wasn't enough kind of long-term scenario information to be able to launch into more about it. I think that It's still in the investigative stages. And I'm sad to report that the one I had, even though it's in a location my body accepted a surface piercing, where I have my bindi on my forehead that's been there since the 90s, I was able to heal a piercing there. And just below it, I got a microdermal by Didier, who is one of the founders of that particular form of body art. Yep. And he did a beautiful job, and I loved it, and it grew out. So.
Really?
That was my personal experience, which I know isn't everybody's, but so I think I would have to say it warrants further investigation for that one.
Fair enough. Going back to the book, though, what kind of stuff did you have to cut out of it? Was it just further explanations on things, or was there...
I lost a few sections. I try not to think and weep too much about what didn't go in, because I could do that. I try not to think about what I had to cut out, to be honest with you. There was more of everything.
Right.
And I mean, not to say that I'm not happy with the book, how it turned out, or that I don't feel that it's quite thorough, or, you know, that it didn't accomplish what I set out to do. I'm happy with how it turned out, and I think my publisher did a fantastic job of putting the information in its best light, even though they didn't know much about piercing. And so, you know, that's all okay, but there was more of everything. When... we did the illustrations, and the first time I saw the illustrations, and they were the size of postage stamps, and I was shocked. And they said, "Well, if you want the illustrations to be larger, you have to cut more text." So it was my book was done, and out of the absolutely done final version, I had to cut out 7 pages of additional text in order to have the illustrations larger. So, so there you go.
Right. So. You said it was about 5 years in the making, but day-to-day, how much time would you spend writing and editing?
At the time I still had my studio, I would take 1 or 2 days a week from my studio and book out and work on the book. There were several, I guess, stretches of that, maybe a year or two of doing some of that. And then after Hurricane Katrina, and I ended up moving to the Yucatan, and we can talk more about that, once I moved here, it became my full-time job, and I worked on it every day. And once I got the publishing deal, I worked on it all day, every day, until the book was done. It was, I've done a variety of things in my life, but I'd have to say that was the most challenging and intense thing I've ever done, and it really stretched me to my limit. I was quite surprised by the demands.
Now, you've been writing articles for The Point and for Pain magazine, was
I
it?
Do.
Yeah, so for a long time. So how much better of a writer do you think you've become from having to sit down and make writing your full-time job every day?
That's a good question. I mean, you might be better qualified to answer it as someone who's not me, who has read some of my writing. I do think I've always been a literalist, and I've always been very into precision, and so those are natural traits of mine. But once you get to this stage of editing a professional book for a professional publisher, wow, I mean, it gets down to the nitty-gritty there. So I think I would definitely say I feel like I've honed my skills and that I'm better as a writer than I used to be. But I would also say that it's still somewhat painful. Truman Capote had a great quote about writing, and he said there's 2 stages to writing, throwing up and cleaning up. And I love that, and I repeat it at every opportunity. So I'm pretty good and quick at throwing up, and I'm really long and slow at cleaning up.
Yeah.
So that's about how I'd have to put it as it still stands.
Okay, so let's actually go on to what you just mentioned about Katrina and living in New Orleans. So you'd run Rings of Desire out of there for over a decade, right?
Mm-hmm, a dozen years. Mm-hmm. Yes, I had Rings of Desire in the French Quarter since the early 90s, and it was the only licensed body art studio in the French Quarter, which is kind of amazing.
Wow.
I didn't know when I moved there that tattooing had been outlawed in the quarter, not for the obvious reasons that everybody would assume in New Orleans, because people are so drunk all the time, which is a good reason to not have tattoo shops there. But it's actually because they had an outbreak of hepatitis in, I think, the 70s, and then they outlawed the whole thing.
Mm.
Well, when I moved there, body piercing wasn't quite on the map as a business or as a career field. So I moved in and I got an occupational license under jewelry and ear piercing, I think it was. And then during the course of my living and working there, I helped the Louisiana legislators to develop legislation for body piercing and tattooing. So once it was legislated, it was lumped together, and at that point they made sure that nobody was doing any form of body art in the quarter except for Rings of Desire, which had been grandfathered in. So that was kind of an amazing stroke of luck there.
Yeah.
And so I love New Orleans. It was great. I had a successful business there. Actually, two successful businesses. I also have a small dog clothing store called Chihuahua Gaga. And that's still there. I have a business partner that runs that. So anyway, in early August of 2005, my husband and I came to the Yucatan in Mexico, and I had had this kind of strange experience where I woke up one day and I knew that we had to move, and I knew that we had to move out of the country, and I started looking for places that weren't too far away from the U.S., heading south because I like hot rather than cold, and didn't want to be on an island or a border. And those were the thoughts in my mind, and I spent many, many hours researching what it took to move out of the country and researching where to move. And it was, in fact, some BME folks who were living in La Paz at that point, and I started looking there.
I was one of them.
What's that?
I was one of them.
I thought you were.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, so some body art weirdos down here. This could be good. And then a friend of mine, and her name is Caitlin, and she's the administrator for the Association of Professional Piercers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she has a brother, and he had a home in this area where I've ended up living, and I had never even heard of it, but she said, well, he says it's really cool there. You should check it out. So I started looking online, and I knew before we had even come here that this would be where we were moving. I picked out a real estate agent and some homes to look at. The first day that we were here, we bought a house.
Wow.
We didn't know anybody here. We didn't speak any Spanish. And I didn't even realize we'd been to the Yucatan before when we visited Tulum on a cruise. I mean, I had no idea, like, where in the world I was just about, other than that it wasn't, you know, it was just, like, due south of New Orleans, about 600 miles. So we came back and started getting our stuff together for a garage sale. And that day we were going to have one, there was all this information on the news about a hurricane coming. And, of course, we did evacuate, and the hurricane did hit, and I've never been the same, and New Orleans has never been the same. It was a really life-altering experience. So we were away for about 6 weeks. I mean, the city was closed. Nobody was allowed in, and we came back as soon as we could, and it was best described as post-apocalyptic. Like, it, you know, it smelled like dead bodies, and there were maggots everywhere, and it was just putrid and disgusting and hideous and horrible there, and you felt like life would never be back to normal again. And in fact, it still isn't quite back to normal in a lot of parts of New Orleans, although the French Quarter is quite lively once again. But we were already planning to move when the hurricane hit, and my main question, I knew that it would be just perfect to live here in Mexico, but what was I going to do with my studio? I didn't know if I was going to travel back and forth or sell it to somebody, or I didn't know what to do. That was my big, huge one question mark. And it was answered for me by Katrina, because she kind of swept most of my employees away. And when I got back, only one of them was really able to return to work. So this decision was made for me to close my studio. And then we ended up moving here in May of 2006 and have lived here very happily ever after since then. So that's the Katrina story.
Now, did you, when you evacuated, did you evacuate immediately when they told you to, or did you get caught up in any of the rush that a lot of people did when they were trying to leave?
We had evacuated on a number of occasions prior, and here we were needing to evacuate again, and my husband said, I'm not going, we're not going, we have water, we have guns, we have food, let's just stay here. And I said, yeah, that's fine, we'll just stay. So later into the night, we're still boarding up windows and things. And in fact, we'd just gotten storm shutters that week, but they weren't hung up yet. So we were putting the hardware on and hanging our shutters. And I was looking at the news. And as time wore on, and they were really predicting a 5 to hit New Orleans pretty directly, I quietly went upstairs and packed a suitcase. And I came back and said, I'm ready to go. We're leaving. And so he really didn't want to go, but I talked him into it. And we left at about 2 in the morning. And there wasn't a taillight in front of us or a headlight behind us. And I thought, this seems really weird. And we got to Houston from New Orleans in about 6 hours or so and got a hotel room. And then the next morning, everybody left. So we got out ahead of time, and my husband was very grateful, and he said he'll listen to me and my gut feelings. So that worked out very well for us.
Right. So have you pierced since you left?
I have done some piercing since I've left. I don't know if you know that I was planning to open a B&B&P here, a bed and breakfast and piercing.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so our house came with like a guest house, and I had a sterilization room built onto it, and I was planning to have people visit and do piercings here, and it's a great idea, and I would have loved to do it, but there's a number of things that got in the way, and one is the water quality here. Like, I don't brush my teeth with it, so I wouldn't want somebody to wash a new piercing in it either, especially somebody who's not used to it. And then there's things like my husband travels, and I wouldn't want to necessarily be home alone with whoever might show up for a piercing. You know, it's one thing to have a studio that's public, and it's another thing to invite strangers into your home.
Yeah, absolutely.
And another is that we live a little outside the city, so I would really turn into kind of a babysitter as well as a piercer. Like, I couldn't really expect somebody to find their way here and all that. So it didn't turn out to be as practical as I thought, but I did open, and I did have one person come for piercing, and I did pierce a couple of neighbors, and then my guest house started falling apart, and that's been renovated a couple times, and I don't know what's the latest story on that. And then I do some guest piercing when I'm in the States. I did a little bit of piercing when I was in San Diego, and I'm going to be doing some piercing in Pasadena and Long Beach on May 13th and 15th, respectively. And I do plan to do some kind of book signing, guest piercing engagements around the country, and I'm going to be talking to my colleagues at the AAP conference about setting those up.
Do you miss doing it full-time, though?
When I was totally in the throes of my book, I didn't miss anything except sleeping and eating. But now that the book is done and we're moving on to another phase, I'm really excited about getting to do more piercing. I have missed it, and I dream about it a lot. It's usually nightmares, like I'm about to pierce somebody and I realize I'm not wearing gloves, or, you know, those crazy piercing nightmares. So yes, I miss it, and I look forward to piercing again.
What brought you to New Orleans in the first place?
It was kind of an interesting thing that happened there, too. I had a friend in California who died when he was 28. His name was Cliff. And at the end of his life, when he was saying that he wished he'd done more things and been more places, I was just totally stricken by that. And I decided that I needed to really hear what he was saying. So I had lived in Los Angeles for 33 years, my whole life. And I said, I'm moving, and I'm going to open my own business somewhere. So I spent almost a year on the road doing guest piercing, traveling around the country, and then New Orleans picked me. I think Cliff picked it, too. That was a funny story. Cliff was a very flamboyant character, and he had his ashes, when he was cremated, mixed with gold glitter and distributed in little bottles to his friends,
yep.
Little contact lens cases. So I had this really cool antique necklace, a little glass vial with a silver top, and I wore it as a necklace, and Cliff was with me always. So we were in New Orleans. I did two piercing visits here on that year of travels, and Cliff jumped off my neck in New Orleans, and the necklace broke, and I said, okay, Cliff wants to be here, and so do I. So that's kind of what happened. But it was a really good pick, because it was a city that wasn't near any of the gauntlets, which was something that made me feel comfortable, because I didn't want to compete with Jim, and we're on friendly terms.
Right.
And also, there certainly wasn't any real professional piercing much going on in that area at the time. And that it's a place where you can be yourself and people appreciate you for that. You know, New Orleans is a place where people kind of do their own thing. So that was good.
Right. Now, you said there weren't any licensed body art studios other than yours. Were there others that were operating outside of the law, or...?
There were one or two that opened very briefly and shut back down. And there are some, there's a tattoo studio right across from the French Quarter and one just two blocks down from the edge of the quarter. But no, really the whole time I was there, there was nobody else right in the quarter doing piercing or tattooing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I miss New Orleans, but the New Orleans I miss, I don't think is the same one that's there anymore. Like, you know, it was the pre-Katrina era, and I think the vibe of the city is different, and, you know, I don't know if it will ever be the same, but I think it's still coming back to whatever it will become. It's still in a recovery phase. Sad.
Yeah, it was funny. I don't know if you remember, but a friend and I were actually planning to come to New Orleans for my birthday in 2005, and my birthday is August 28th. So
it's your fault.
never actually made it, thankfully.
Have you been there on other occasions before?
I've never been there. I've not made it yet.
It's still worth going. Actually, Jazz Fest is an amazing time, which is just right now, the last weekend of April and the first weekend of May. Jazz Fest is fantastic, and Halloween in New Orleans totally rocks too.
So going back to California, though, when did you actually start piercing?
Well, I certainly first remember piercing myself in the early 70s and piercing friends at home in the mid 70s. And it wasn't until the 80s that I became more professional at it.
Right.
So I've been poking at people for years. And no, I wasn't very professional at it at first. And I did learn a certain amount of what I know the hard way. But there are better ways now.
Yeah.
And so it was a process. The whole gauntlet thing was kind of funny too, because when I applied for the job, I put on my business suit and I brought my resume, and it was all very businesslike. And I had been to business school not long before that, and so Jim Ward interviewed me, and we did this whole kind of regular job interview kind of thing. And he said, "Okay, well that's great. Let's give it a try." And by the way, how are your piercing skills? And I said, oh, better than most, which I'm sure was true, but it wasn't necessarily saying a whole lot.
Right.
So he kind of left me to it at first, and I remember a conversation on the phone with him, and he said, so how's it going there? Because he was living in San Francisco at the time, where there wasn't a gauntlet yet. There was still just Gauntlet LA, and I was managing it and doing the best I could at kind of reinventing the piercing wheel. And he said, how's it going? And I said, well, pretty good. I can do that piercing part, but how do you get the jewelry in? So, you know, he came down and showed me a couple of pointers on that, and that helped a whole lot. So it was pretty informal back then, too. You know, it wasn't really quite the formal apprenticeship that eventually came out of that school of thought.
Right. Now, aside from Gauntlet in those days, what were the options for getting pierced?
Gauntlet has been open since the 70s,
yeah.
And pretty much most points since then, until the early 90s, there really weren't any professional options to speak of. Body Manipulations in San Francisco was one of the first other piercing specialty places, and there were a couple of people. There was a guy, Linus, in Cleveland, and then there was Jack Yunt in Florida, and Sailor Sid. So there were like these few little pockets around the country where people were kind of, it was sort of an SM kind of avenue of piercing. A lot of these were SM practitioners who kind of started learning how to pierce their friends. And so really it wasn't for a couple more years that piercing studios started becoming more common. At the time I first started managing Gauntlet, it was still the only piercing studio in the country. And when Jim wrote his endorsement for my book, that was when I found out that it was the only piercing studio in the world. I didn't really realize that at the time. But on my book, he wrote, no one is more qualified to write this book than Elaine Angel. With more than 3 decades of personal experience to her credit, she knows no one knows the subject better. And when I talked to him about it, he said, no, that Gauntlet was still the only one anywhere at that time.
Oh.
So, yeah. And then, you know, there was a guy, Stacy, in Dallas, and he called me up, and as much as is possible, I helped him learn to pierce over the phone from Gauntlet. So it just kind of started popping up all around the country. But when I started, there were a couple of tattooers. Cap Sumsky was doing some piercing, and he told me that if his boss at the tattoo shop knew that he was piercing, he'd get fired because his boss thought it was disgusting and perverted. Like, it was, you know, now we think of these things as almost one and the same, piercing, tattooing. You know,
yeah.
It's just a family of body art. But way back when I started, it really wasn't the case. And I tried very hard to get a booth at the National Tattoo Association convention, and they wouldn't even have the courtesy of returning my messages. Like, you know, we were shunned. We were not part of the tattooing world, and we were on our own for quite some while there. So the world has changed so much since then. I know Jim never thought, and I certainly never thought, that piercing would be something that everybody knew about. I mean, when I got my nipples pierced in 1981, my gynecologist called up my parents, even though I was of age, and broke patient confidentiality in order to tell my parents that my nipples were pierced and that I mentioned that I might be interested in genital piercing, because they thought I might need to be institutionalized. Right. This was not acceptable. It was not okay. It was not something normal people did. And to have witnessed the transformation of that has been incredible. It's really come a long way, baby.
Yeah, the fact that now people can go to a doctor and have serious, not just piercings, but like pseudo-surgical genital modifications, and have that be not something worth institutionalizing is pretty amazing, considering where it was not too long ago.
Yeah, it is. I think that's an area where we can say some progress has been made in our lifetimes.
Absolutely.
When I first got my tongue pierced, I told everybody that it was an acupuncture stud for weight control, and I put that in my book. And nobody ever disbelieved me. They didn't for a second think that it was a piercing for fun. They never heard of such a thing. So, of course, it must have been an acupuncture stud for weight control. And I'd go on, oh, yeah, it satisfies your palate, and you don't eat without thinking about it. And, you know, I had this whole thing, and they believed me. Everybody did.
Mm-hmm. Now,
things have changed.
Yeah. So when you started piercing yourself and piercing others, were you inspired by anything, or was it just something that you felt like you had to do?
You know, I didn't come from the kind of tribal background on piercing or body art. Once I found my way to the SM part of it, that was definitely something that resonated for me. But as a child, I was doing surgeries on fruits and vegetables and dead fish, and like, I've always been medically inclined, and my dad's a doctor, and my favorite dinner time conversation was what interesting cases came into the emergency room. And so it came more from that, my kind of interest in things medical. And I've just always wanted to pierce my body. When I was 5, I was pressing little pearls onto my earlobes, these little tiny beads, mm-hmm. and I'd press them on so hard they would stay, because
right.
I wanted to look like I had pierced ears. And for 2 years, I relentlessly begged my parents to let me pierce my ears, and when I was 7, they finally did. My dad pierced them for me with this actually a cool, completely autoclavable kind of piercing gun that used to exist back
really?
In the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's put in a very sharp stud that I think did a lot less tissue damage than the kind we see more commonly. And I did some of my subsequent piercings with that same Frankenstein stud. It was a very long cylindrical, it was very Frankenstein. It was really cool. So then when I was 15, I pierced the tissue below the prominent bone on my wrist. Like, I was searching my body. I didn't know what the possibilities were, but I knew I wanted to look into them. So it's been a kind of lifelong fascination.
So you've obviously been around the industry and the community
forever.
Practically invented it. Let's just start with a really broad question. How has it changed for you? Like, just like as someone who was there for its formative years, looking at it now from when you started, not just in terms of like the acceptance that we talked about from the mainstream, say, but just in terms of the industry itself, the community itself, and the people who are participating in it.
Well, when I started, and when there was still just one piercing studio around in the country or the world, there were some very specific subsets of people who were getting pierced, and very little else. There were the gay leather community, and the women's leather community, and the pansexual leather community. So it was all kind of the BDSM crowd was one of the very key primary client bases for early piercing
at
Gauntlet.
And I think people, a lot of people today, don't realize just how important the BDSM community was to piercing as it exists today.
They were the piercing community.
Yeah.
There was no other community. I mean, it was, you know, the kind of the next folks were the rockers and some of the music industry kind of people, and then some of the other kind of celebrity folks, because we were in West Hollywood. But it all started with the BDSM folks, and it was all about sex. And it was about pierced nipples and pierced genitals, and there was very little else going on, comparatively speaking. And so the community, such as it is, has changed dramatically since I first began piercing, because now absolutely anybody might get pierced. There's, you know, the piercing community is the world community. There's obviously, as we know, no one type of person, and they're getting everything we can think of and then some pierced. So it just couldn't have changed more. And that BDSM part of it was huge in its initiation into this culture.
Back then, could you have foreseen that it would have ended up the way it is today?
And not in a million years. I would never, ever have imagined even a time where, say, everybody knew what piercing was, no less, everybody might get one. You know, really, anybody might get pierced now. And at the time, way back then, there were, you know, older individuals, mature people getting nipple and genital piercings, but again, they were the SM people. They weren't just like a soccer mom who didn't have any handcuffs in the bedroom. It was it was very specific. And now, absolutely anybody and everybody. And I did not see that coming. And as far as whether I think it's positive or not, absolutely. I mean, piercing is something I'm obviously extremely passionate about and always have been. And if people get a fraction of the joy and delight out of their piercings that I get out of mine, then yes, absolutely, it's a great thing, because now it's open to everyone, and because it's become so much more acceptable, it's just, you know, it's just not that big a deal. It's A-okay. So yeah, I think historically, and I am speaking tribally, and you know, all throughout history, aesthetics has been an acceptable motivation for tribal people to get pierced, and if that's somebody's main motivation today, I don't think that lessens the validity of it. I think it's okay to get pierced because you like the way it looks. It doesn't have to be, like, deeply, seriously motivated to be meaningful or for me to seem right. I do think that some people get pierced just because their friends have it, and, you know, they might take it out later, and if they enjoy the experience and go through it, and, you know, that's fine. It's fine. I mean, it's not for everybody, obviously.
No, what are your thoughts on, say, age limits?
I'm pretty strict with my age limit policy, possibly maybe more because of, laws that could impact it. They're not necessarily piercing laws, but, say, laws on reckless endangerment of a minor or something of that nature. So my studio policy was that a parent had to be present, and they had to prove their relationship. If they didn't have the same last name, I needed to see a divorce decree or a new marriage license or something to explain the connection. And it was 16 and up for navels and facial piercing. I didn't do nipples or genitals on minors under any circumstances except one, which was an emancipated minor who was 17 who had a child. And I didn't even want to do it, but my attorney said, in the state of Louisiana, an emancipated minor is an adult, she's married, she has a child, feel free. So, short of that, I don't feel comfortable piercing minors. And as far as infants or babies, my perspective there is that I don't want to pierce anyone who can't consent to it and know what it is they're consenting to. So I will only pierce a child old enough to say, I want you to pierce my ears, and yes, I know what it means, and that it might hurt for a second, and that I can't touch them with my dirty fingers.
Right. Is there anything that you see in the industry nowadays that concerns you?
No, not just nowadays. It's been going on for a little while. Is people sometimes trying too hard to invent something new without considering potential ramifications or without really figuring out what's going on with the anatomy and what the real risks are. I'm teaching an anatomy course, or co-teaching with Dr. Dan Natkeel at the upcoming APP conference, and he's going to be going over some of that. And because he's a doctor, maybe people will listen to him. But, you know, piercing subclavicular, you know, below the clavicle, there's arteries there, and you wouldn't be able to stop bleeding because you can't apply pressure to that area. So, you know, some of the inventive is cool, but when it doesn't have, like, some science or medical knowledge to back it up, it really scares me what people do sometimes. I know I'm on the conservative side, and I readily admit that, but some of the things people are doing are really, truly dangerous. And I also have to say that on the one hand, I'm all for your body as your own to do with what you want. I mean, I've certainly done what I want with mine.
Yeah.
But there's some other responsibilities professional piercers have, you know, in a studio environment as sort of guardians of our clientele and supposed professionals. So I do have some concerns with some of the dangerous piercings people do.
Yeah, that's always been a big debate, is that people having autonomy over their own bodies, but if they're trying to extend that autonomy into having other people do potentially dangerous things to them, is that...
Well, for me, I have very strong personal boundaries, and I could never let people talk me into doing piercings that I didn't feel comfortable doing. Like, certainly many, many a client had come in to ask me to do whatever it was, whether they were just anatomically unsuited or whether it was a piercing that I feel shouldn't be done on anybody. You know, as the professional in the situation, I have the prerogative to decline. There's certainly the person's prerogative to seek out someone else to do it, mm-hmm. but I have my strong boundaries about what I feel comfortable with. So I'm not the one to turn to for somebody to do extreme things that I find are dangerous, but it doesn't mean I don't think they should get them. I'm just not the person for the job.
All right, fair enough. Is there anything that you really enjoy or that you think is a really cool thing that you personally don't feel comfortable doing?
Sure. Probably. Absolutely. I think tongue splitting is kind of fascinating, but as someone with 5 tongue piercings on my midline, obviously I would lose them, and so I wouldn't get that done, and it isn't something I perform as a service, but it's very intriguing to me, at least when it looks aesthetic, you know, when the wound is smooth and nicely epithelialized. But, I mean, there's plenty of things people do that I think are, like, cool looking or an interesting idea, but that I wouldn't do or have done, yeah.
And I guess that, like, a lot of this is even an issue now because of what you're saying before, that now body piercing and tattooing and scarification and, like, pseudo-surgical things like tongue splitting and even suspension, they're all under this umbrella of body modification now. And do you think that commingling of everything has been beneficial?
I guess that depends on what you mean by beneficial. I think that in the sense that people are a lot more aware of what options exist in life to do with your body, you know, things you can do with your body or not. And in that sense, yes, I think it's great. I think education is important. I think having information available is great. So I'm all for that. I haven't actually personally been suspended, because I don't want to poke holes in my tattoo primarily, but right. The concept of it appeals to me, and I have participated in putting hooks in people, and I, you know, it's certainly not something I disapprove of. I just think I find, say, getting pierced and wearing a permanent piercing quite different in many, many ways from those other types of things that you do as an event or temporarily. And I like plate piercing, too, from both sides of that coin. So I don't have judgment against it. I just don't find them to necessarily be the same thing. Did I answer your question?
I think so. I think, I mean...
Okay. I do ramble a bit.
I just mean, do you think it's appropriate for, like, just like, say, for piercing and tattoos and scarification and implants, like, should that all be considered the same thing to you? Or do you think...
I think that putting them under an umbrella of body modification makes them the same, and I think all of the things that are different about them also make them different. So they have their areas of connectedness and their areas of separateness.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
I don't know, we covered a lot of ground there, so I don't know, unless there's anything else that you're dying to get to, I guess we could let you plug your book once more and then let you pack for Vegas.
Okay, well... You've been hearing Elaine Angel ramble on, and I am the the author of The Piercing Bible, The Definitive Guide to Safe Body Piercing. And if you need more information, you can go to, piercingbible.com.
Excellent. And in stores everywhere, I guess?
Or? In stores everywhere. And also, I do want to add on top of that, that after conference, the APP will be selling signed copies of my book, which aren't available elsewhere. And also a portion of the proceeds goes to the APP. So you might be able to find it at a discount elsewhere, but you won't be supporting the organization or getting a signed copy. So there's that pitch.
Perfect. Good to know.
Thanks so much for talking to me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Absolutely. It was a good time. Thank you.
Okay. All right, talk to you later.
Thanks, Lane.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.